Hi, everyone, and welcome to ABCs of Anesthesia on this podcast and on YouTube. Now, today, I've got a special guest with us, Dr. Anne. And look, to start with, we're going to talk about one of the rarest complications that you'll ever have in anesthesia, which is the can't intubate, can't oxygenate scenario and surgical, you know, surgical airway and the performing the surgical airway. So there's many of us that have never, ever even come close to this just because of how rare and how unique each circumstance is. But Anne has actually done this twice, and I thought it'd be a perfect opportunity to ask Anne about everything. Now, just a bit of background with Anne. So she's a fellow of the Australian New Zealand College of Anaesthetists. So she's a FASCA like myself. I think, Anne, you were the first trainee at Western Health, was that?
Yes.
Yeah, wow.
Yes. So I'm one of the first trainees of the pioneering program of Western Health, yes.
Beautiful. And now I work there, and we work together in our private group as well as well as at Western Health. She has both appointments in public and private, so, you know, just a very experienced anaesthetist from Melbourne, Australia. She has a lot of interest. Like, she really does a whole gamut of, you know, anaesthesia for surgeries, including gynae, vascular, urology, orthopedics, pediatric, and especially special needs dentistry, general surgery, and endoscopy. So a lot of airway experience from that. And she enjoys teaching trauma and airway courses to doctors in training. So that's a bit of a summary. Now, the biggest disclaimer here is that this is an extremely rare but also very high-risk event. So any of the chat that we have is obviously going to be de-identified, and none of this is specific advice. So, you know, by having this conversation or listening to this conversation, you're just not expected to be able to go out and perform the insane kind of anesthetic techniques that are required in this situation. And they're such a specialist level, and every patient's unique, and it's an absolutely a team approach. So please don't take this as any specific advice. And really, I thought we'd just have a chat about, you know, a few of the technical stuff as well as the psychology bit and the human factors. Hey, so welcome, Anne. How's it going?
Thank you for having me, Lehu.
No, thanks for having me. Look, I thought we'd actually just go through, because the NAP4, the National Audit Project, these are done in the UK, and they're amazing, you know, I guess, surveys of practice about really small events or very low incidence events. And I'll just quickly go through that to give people a bit of a framework. And then we'll go through, I might actually ask you about your understanding of CICO and the way it's evolved in general, and then we'll go into those cases. So the National Audit Project is by the Royal College of Anaesthetists in the UK and the Difficult Airway Society, and is really designed to answer a couple of questions. So what kind of airway device are used during anaesthesia, and how often? And how often do major complications leading to serious harm occur in association with airway management and anaesthesia in the intensive care units as well as emergency departments in the UK? So what they really found was really interesting stuff. For example, approximately 2.9 million general anaesthetics are administered in the UK National Health Service each year. About 56% of these cases, the airway management is with supraglottic airway device, so that's like a LMA. 38% with a tracheal tube and 5% with a face mask. Obviously, this has changed dramatically since the advent of LMAs from, I think, in the 90s. There was 184 reports meeting their criteria of, you know, severe airway consequence, 133 relating to general anesthesia, which is 46 events per million general anesthetics, or one per 22,000. So, you know, this is obviously incredibly rare when you think the death on, you know, by a car accident on the roads is around the one in 10,000 in both the UK and Australia. So mortality of 5.6 per million general anesthetics, or one every 180,000. I just drilled down into the stats for the actual emergency surgical airway. It was about 80 of these 184 cases. And roughly an emergency surgical airway was attempted in 58. And that comes down to about 58 out of the 2.9 million is about one in 50,000 surgical airways. And only 11 of those were true emergency rescue techniques, which will be in your example. And that was about less than one in 250,000. So just get these numbers. Death on the roads every year is about one in 10,000. Anaphylaxis is about one in 5,000 to one in 10,000 cases. Or, you know, up to one in 20,000 cases, and this is less than one in 250,000. So it's extremely rare, an extremely stressful time, and very unpredictable in many instances. So let's go to you, Anne. So CICO has evolved a lot over the last few decades. What was your experience of learning CICO back in training, and how you think of it now?
Well, back in training, there wasn't a lot. It wasn't streamlined. there wasn't formalized training. And compared to when I first started and when I had to do the CICO to now, you know, we've got regular training, simulations, and each theater in most major hospitals would now have a dedicated unit of CICO devices in each theater that was available when I, had the opportunity or chance to help out in those two CICO scenarios that I'll share with you guys.
Yeah. Hey, so do you remember, I don't know, when I was training, everyone had some kind of MacGyver-level technique, you know, we're going to cut the neck with this, put a pen through there or a 40-gauge, and the patient theoretically just breathe on the 40-gauge or a three-way tap to a oxygen cylinder, lure lock connector, you know, function from an oxygen device. Was that kind of the stuff that people were telling you to do?
That was my MacGyver moment. That was one of my first MacGyver moments, actually. Yeah. So the first incident that I had to be involved in was in about 2008, 2009. So that was, I remember that was second week of my second year training, doing a night shift. I got a call from an ENT resident at the time to say, hey, can you come and help out to assess an airway? This is a middle-aged gentleman that had, early in the day, had neck dissection. And he's now, you know, stridling, sets is dropping. So I went up to see the patient, assess as you would, and he's clearly had signs of impending airway. Neck is swollen, so we suspect bleeding. We suspected bleeding at the time. And, I contacted my consultant, the ENT consultant or fellow was contacted with the aim of taking this gentleman back to theater for re-exploration. Mm-hmm. Like all airway cases, they evolve extremely quickly. Mm-hmm. So a minute while we were assessing a patient, the next minute he's gone completely unconscious on us.
Wow.
So it all happened very quickly and the swelling has become so prominent. There was code blue call, so we can get extra help. And I was managing the airway at the time, being the anesthetic registrar on call that night. Mm-hmm. I wasn't able to backmask ventilate.
And so he became unconscious as you were kind of there and the situation evolving. Was that unconscious due to hypoxemia, do you think?
Hypoxemia, yeah, he was unconscious. That's when I arrived on the ward, he was sitting upright, stridling, sets in the 80s. So that within, 5 minutes or less than 10, he's become unconscious.
And did you see the sets dropping?
Sets was definitely dropping. This is quite a few years ago now, so probably in the 20% or 40% very quickly in the space of between the next 5 to 10 minutes since I arrived onto the ward. So while all this is happening, we're trying to get theatre, trying to get senior consultants or registrars to attend for return to theatre. Mm-hmm. So code blue was called while the patient's still on the ward. So imagine a night shift, I think it was midnight around that time. Minimal staff available. In a ward environment, and the patients clearly had extensive swelling on one side of the neck. Mm-hmm. I managed to put in a Goodell airway, but I could not ventilate him. Mm-hmm. And at the time, this is the time where we don't have LMA in our resuscitation trolley. Mm-hmm. So I've called for help from theatre, for nursing staff from theatre to send up several devices of LMAs. As rescue airway. In the meantime, we continue to backmask to the best of our ability. And when we have a fast track LMA, we inserted that, not able to ventilate through the LMA, unable to intubate him. And patient, as this is progressing, patients is needing CPR at the same time. So,
and just to clarify, so. And the fast track LMA is the intubatable LMA, so it's gone in there. Still no rise and fall of the chest. Do you have end-tidal CO2 at this point on a monitor at all? No, okay.
Nothing.
And someone's checked the pulse, and now the pulse.
Someone's checked the pulse, and now he's in full cardiac respiratory arrest.
Yeah.
Okay. So CPR was commenced, and funny talk about the MacGyver technique of rescue oxygenation. It was something that I had only learned or talked to a consultant informally as part of teaching in theatre about rescue oxygenation. We talked about three-way taps and, So that's what I did because it wasn't the neck was completely swollen. There wasn't on intubation. There wasn't identifier, an enemy. So I had very limited choice at the time with very little anesthetic experience, but this is at a situation of life and death. And that teaching had come in very handy. So we, so I used a 14 gauge needle technique, attach your syringe with a little bit of fluid. It wasn't straightforward. I have to say it was multiple attempts because I just don't have the normal anatomy to work with. I remember prior to that, because the neck was quite swollen, was obvious. I remembered removing the first layer of skin suture, removing the second layer of suture that I could felt, stables I could felt. It didn't make a lot of difference. I'll come back to that, and that's certainly a point that I've learned through this incident. So none of that had helped. So that's when I embarked on rescue oxygenation with a 14-gauge needle. After several attempts, I have to say, it was a pretty scary moment as a second-year registrar, night shift on your own. So after several attempts, I eventually got feedback to say that, yes, I'm likely in the trachea. There was air aspirated through the syringe, through your catheter, oxygen tubing, 15 litres on the wall. And, you know, just by doing that, we were managed to, he had spontaneous circulation. We could stop CPR.
Wow. Hey, just to give people a sense of it, imagine a neck without the anatomy. So you can't feel the trachea. So all you've got to go by is some semblance of that's probably the midline. And there's a union, like a, you know, a mass on one side pressuring anatomy and causing distortion. And there's CPR going on. So then everything's moving and you've got to try and find this spot. I think what you said at the start as well, really interesting, because, you know, for any kind of neck surgery, often it's the thyroidectomies, parathyroidectomies, or neck dissections. The teaching is to remove the sutures, and, you know, through like learning, you know, you think like every neck dissection type case, so the thyroid case, has a scalpel and the kit to remove it in the event of extremis. Sounds really weird. You've got this massive bleed happening and removing the sutures to let the blood out. So you'll be getting a lot of bleeding, to release the pressure on the airway is exactly what you need to do. But it's also really subtle. You have to remove the superficial layers and the deep sutures, because that's often where the collection is. And, you know, that needs to be taught. And it's a thing that resident training for surgical rotations goes through that training in our hospital. So it's really valuable. So, okay, you're at the point now where you've managed to aspirate air. You think you're in the trachea. You connect a three-way tap to the cannula and you connect oxygen tubing to the end of three-way tap.
Yep.
Because then the lure lock fits into the oxygen with a bit of force. That's and that right. goes to oxygen 15 litres.
15 litres on the from the wall. So you have, with the three-way tap, you have your outlet that you would inject 1 second and release for 4 seconds to reduce barotrauma. So by just that rescue oxygenation, we were able to reverse, we were able to stop doing CPR.
Wow. And just to clarify that, so the teaching now, it's really obviously good that you did that. These days we have devices called the Leroy, the RapidFlow device, big outlet, so you can definitely get exhalation. They've done studies with the three-way tap systems where, in spite of letting not occluding the third part of the three-way tap, you still get constant flow. So there is a risk of barotrauma in some cases. So, you know, when you have nothing else, you need to go for it or something. But these days we've got a device that exhales a lot better.
Yeah. So this was certainly at the start of my training, CICO wasn't a very streamlined teaching, and devices, specialized customized devices for occasions like this were not available. They were certainly not readily available, not even theater at the time. And we're talking about a ward, a normal surgical ward. This is clearly not the best way of doing it, but at the time of not having any other specialized equipment, this was enough to temporize the resuscitation. Right.
If you have nothing else, this is easily the best thing to do.
That was all I had at the time.
Yeah.
That was all I had and all I knew how to use at the time. And thankfully, what makes it, saturation wasn't great. Well, I still remember in the 60s or 70s, but we got something. We got a pulse back. We could stop doing CPR. And while we're still, you know, coordinating theatre to go back to to deal. A lot of things are happening, obviously, at around that time. An ENT fellow arrived on the ward, rocked up, and I remember him sticking his finger right into the neck, pretty much right to the trachea, and removed another layer of suture. That was the third deep layer of suture that I did not get to, and that was what made the difference. A gush of blood came out.
Wow.
A gush of blood came out, and you could see that the neck swelling, I wouldn't say normalized, but you could see that you could slowly sort of feel the trachea. Yes, I can see the trachea being deviated, but I can start to feel it now. And that
And did he use his fingers physically to there weren't any cutters in there. It's just his fingers to release the sutures.
Just his fingers, because I still remember I was guarding the 40-year-old with my life. And the ENT registrar approached and just stuck his finger right really deep, because I removed the first layer, second layer, it didn't make a difference. So, you know, really right down to where the culprit is, the very last layer.
Wow.
And that's where hematoma was released.
Yep.
And then subsequently what makes a difference is I am now able, not great, but I subsequently was able to ventilate through the intubating LMA that was sitting in there the whole time.
Oh, wow. So
despite not working, I left it in there. I didn't remove it. I was guarding the cannula in the neck with my life, oxygenating through that. So as we're doing that, you know, there was some complication of surgical emphysema.
Yeah.
That occurred.
On that point, I love the fact you said guarding that needle. Again, you've got this needle. There's a couple of inches in there. It's flimsy. It's not secured. And I know that from running simulation teaching in these situations, so many times people don't guard the cannula and it dislodges. You know, it was a hard-fought cannula, you know, keeping the patient oxygenated. And because, you know, things happen and people are busy, there's a lot of noise in the room, people forget to just hold it for dear life, which is exactly what you did. I think that's great.
Yeah. So that was the thing that reversed CPR, that we could stop doing CPR. So I just had to, that was the only thing that was keeping him alive at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when the ENT fellow released the hematoma, I could actually ventilate, not great still, but I can see glimpses of CO2 appearing on the monitor that we've got, which we didn't have up until that point.
Right. Can I ask you, the decision to go for the needle versus a scalpel bougie surgical airway technique, what made you decide one or the other?
At the time when I had to do it, I haven't been introduced or taught how to do a scalpel technique.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no formal teaching.
Yeah.
Needle is something that I have been taught. We've read about it in textbooks, and you know, and it's something that I'm very familiar with being an anaesthetist.
Mm.
It's readily available.
Mm.
Yeah. So we're talking about the ward environment. I can get a needle, find a syringe, normal saline very easily. I'm not sure how readily available scalpels are, but that wasn't my area of comfort.
Yeah, exactly. If you haven't been shown, we'll go through the HERD algorithm after this. But yeah, once that was a well-taught, well-worn kind of protocol, procedure algorithm, I feel like now, you know, decision makes a lot better. Again, you go with what you know. And I'm so lucky for the patient that you had a chat about this and you knew that this was, you know, the only way you could save this patient.
Yeah, and you have very little time to think, because the man just rested pretty much in front of you in the space of 5 to 10 minutes. Mm. It's very much what you knew at the time that you think you could do.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so now you've got the LMA in, you've got some kind of ventilation. The SATs are at this point?
SATs is recordable. For memory, it will be 60 to 80s.
Okay. But you're not getting internal CO2, you're getting volumes.
That's right. Enough to say, yep, stable. Let's quickly go to theatre for transfer.
Yep. Okay.
And by the time we transferred the theatre, consultants arrived, and it was difficult. It was grade three intubation. The consultant took over the intubating. Was grade three, and subsequently, when we look back at the elective intubation early in the day, this gentleman was a grade 2B.
Yeah,
difficult to start with. That's right. It was challenging to start with. It became impossible when there was hematoma and swelling in the neck.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Okay, interesting. And so in theatre, that used a grade three view, I suspect without a video learning scope, managed to get a bougie down or?
Yeah, the consultant took over at the time of intubating because there was a lot of concerns with the neck now is swelling because of my needle with surgical emphysema. He's a gentleman who is clearly critically unwell. We wanted to use the most experienced hand at the time for intubation as possible. So the consultant did the first attempt at intubation. Yes, I believe Muji was used.
Yep.
Yeah, but it was first attempt. It was first attempt successful.
Okay, and they had video learning scopes at that time. Oh, no, they didn't. So this was a normal direct Macintosh blade.
Right. Yeah.
and used a bougie to get the tube past the cord. It was a grade three view, as your listeners might know. It's where you see the epiglottis, but you can't see the cords at all. And if it's the most, you know, it's not uncommon to get a grade three. You can often just put the bougie around and feel the tracheal ring so you know you're in. But these days with the video laryngoscope, you'd almost go straight to that and just make sure that the bougie is in and the tube is subsequently in as well. Yeah.
So when I attempted on the ward, he's clearly grade four. I can't see anything identifiable with a hematoma on. So I think, you know, what eventually really made the difference was the release of that hematoma that was done by the ENT fellow.
Wow.
So lesson learned, one layer sutures, not enough, second layer and third layer until whatever's bleeding comes out. And that gentleman was bleeding from a external jugular vein, and that's why it's
helpful. Oh, wow. What are the chances? I mean, just to go through the CIC algorithm. So back in the day, you know, there was a lot of talk about what you could do, but people hadn't really tested this in real life. It's a low incidence situation. So there's a lot of things. I remember being taught a similar thing, you know, put a needle, a 14 gauge. They didn't specify the kind of 14 gauge, three-way tap oxygen system. But the fact is that this isn't the ideal system. And there's other ways you can do this now, which, you know, with a rapid flow device or one of the Cook, I think it's called a magic flute system. I'll link to all of these in below. But then Andrew Heard, anesthetist from West Australia, what he did was he did these experiments in the wet lab, essentially sheep that were already being bled out for agar, for, you know, agar dishes, for microbiology. He said, well, the sheep are, you know, are dying anyway. Why don't we use them to help train this? And what they did was they did the studies on this to find that actually, you know, anesthetists essentially go through two pathways. One of them is they can feel anatomy, they try a needle technique, and that gets converted, and you get oxygenation, then convert it to a size 6 Melker tracheotomy type system. Or you can go through the scalpel bougie technique, where you have a scalpel bougie into the trachea and then a size 6 tube. I've got videos of this all on the CICO playlist on YouTube, so you can see all of these on mannequins being done. And then if you can't feel anatomy, you can do a scalpel finger, which is surgically incising vertically on the neck, finger dissection, and then doing a needle or a scalpel technique after that. That's if you cannot feel the anatomy. And so there's this really well-worn path now that Andrew Heard and his group have created, which is, I think, revolutionized surgical airway training. And it's amazing all the good things you did just even without knowing that, which is, you know, so thankful. I'm sure the patient is very thankful that you were there.
I have to say, even informal teaching, you know, take this opportunity to teach your junior doctors or registrars, because I'd certainly benefited, or patient benefited from that, because it was just informal teaching. There was no sim sessions or things like that about CSCO back in the days, and that just gave me the confidence or the need, the clinical need to understanding to let's do it now. It's too late.
Yeah. Hey, so I will definitely ask you about the human factors and decision-making and just, I guess, organizing all the anesthesia non-technical skills. How about let's go through the second case before we do that. What happened in the second time?
So the second time around, I've actually now a consultant. I was 6 months into my consultancy. It was the end of my shift, saying goodbye to a colleague, another senior consultant. He was on call that day, and he just said, Anne, would you mind stay back a little bit? ED say there's an impending airway. Maybe just, you know, if you're happy to hang around, can you help out? It's like, sure, let's go have a look. So we went to ED to see a morbidly obese gentleman, dental abscess, sitting up, struggling, not able to swallow his saliva, spitting into a bucket at a time. And So clearly, you know, it's a case that I would be very willing to stay back to help out. So the plan was the I'll call him the duty anesthetist because it was after hours, he's the in charge. It's his on call shift. So duty anesthetist stayed with the patient in ED while I go back to theatre to get set up. Idea is to set up everything, including a fibroproptic intubation, difficult airway, in theatre to do it in a more sort of secure environment. So we were, the understanding was the duty anesthetists would give me a call when he's leaving ED, coming to theatre so I can gather all the extra nursing help personnel ready. And that in 2013, yes, we have video laryngoscope by the time.
Yeah, you win.
Yes. So that is one improvement. And LMA is now mandatory in all resus trolleys. You know, how
that's
another health, another thing that's evolved over time. But we still don't have the pre-packed CICO kit in every theatre like we have these days.
Yep.
Okay.
And just to give a bit of context, so our theatre has a CICO kit. It was like this flat red bag, I guess, of, you know, pocket. One size scalpel bougie, one size needle crike. It's just completely obvious what to do and what to use, and removes the decision making about gathering stuff that you absolutely need. So anyone in a hospital without an LMA in the emergency cart, without a CICO kit, if they're doing anesthetics, it's just so cheap to have that there. And, you know, it's the one in 250,000 event, but gosh, you absolutely need it when you need it.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, so we did have LMA in theatre, in resus trolley. So by 2013, we have LMA and we have video laryngoscope, but not the dedicated rescue airway devices. So while I was waiting for a phone call to come from the duty anesthetist, expecting him in theatre, I can hear a lot of noise coming down the corridor. this morbidly obese gentleman is being wheeled into theatre with ED personnel jumping on his chest. They were doing CPR. So came into theatre. By the time I see him again the second time in theatre, he was being resuscitated. Yeah. I presume hypoxia-induced arrest. So again, imagine a morbidly obese gentleman, dental abscess. The duty anesthetist, he had the airway at the time. He was back masked with not very much success at all. Video laryngoscope was set up already. So he had the first attempt, grade 4.
Yeah.
You know, anatomies that you can't really identify. And he's asked me to do have another look, to take over the airway as a second attempt. Same thing, can't see anything. And I was in the position, I guess this was second time experiencing a CICO situation. And I know the duty anesthetist very well. He's an extremely experienced senior consultant. If his best attempt is a grade 4 when he was attempting, and you could all see on the screen being grade 4, I knew to already at the time already call out, get a needle crico kit.
Yeah.
So I guess in hindsight, it was good to have that first experience to help me make that call very early on. So
essentially he's working on the top of the airway. He'll go through LMA, bag mask, endotracheal intubation, video laryngoscope.
It was bag masking. Being CPR as he's wheeled down from ED to theatre. So on arrival to theatre, the first thing we did was have a look.
And then
Goodell was ready inside you.
As you can see, there's two things happening. This is parallel management where you have the supraglottic stuff happening with one practitioner. And while that's happening, you're also doing this. You know where this could head. So why not get this equipment set up right there to cut the neck, do your CICO management while that stuff's happening? It doesn't have to happen linearly. It should happen kind of together because you don't
waste. Yeah, it was very lucky. I guess in that time that we had two people, and I know that, you know, this other duty initiatives is very experienced, and given the patient's comorbidities, the fact that I only saw him about 10 minutes ago, he was sitting upright, spitting out his saliva, and now he's been CPR unconscious. Yeah. So that degree of urgency is calling for some sort of rescue oxygenation. So I remember as he was attempting his intubation, I saw what was on the CMAX screen. I call out for a needle cricothyrotomy kit. Well, the nurses, because we haven't got those packs ready available, the nurses have to get them ready. And then I had a quick attempt at intubating again. Mm-hmm. This second attempt, same view. There was nothing identifiable.
Mm-hmm.
And I was already in the position. So I hand back the airway so that the other duty initiators can hold on to back mask while I'm already in the position, right position. The instruments were open already for me.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting this time was I was given an 18-gauge cannula.
Oh, no.
Yeah, they were not prepared. They were not, and I say, the biggest you can find, and that, you know, time, because nurses are not familiar. They didn't have the training either. But thankfully, that was sufficient.
Yeah. Oh, so you put the 18-gauge in?
Yeah. So this gentleman, I could feel his trachea. It's slightly different to the first scenario. Mm. He's morbidly obese. I can feel his. I can't feel exactly where the cricothyroid membrane is. I can't feel. I can roughly know where the center of the neck is.
Mm.
So instead of wasting more time, you know, we're doing CPR. It was very challenging. A big patient, big neck, on an ED trolley, not ideal environment. So instead of wasting more time for nurses who are unfamiliar getting the 14-gauge without safety cannula, for me, I had an attempt.
Yeah.
I had an attempt, and I could get air back straight away.
Wow.
So then he already had the other kit, a Melka kit, just opened.
Oh, so you didn't attach a jet ventilation device at that point? No. It wasn't available, no time, just get the Melka.
Yeah, so it was because the first attempt, I got it, and I remember it was just wire technique. It took less than 30 seconds.
Yes.
Yeah. And also this is part, you know, now we taught to do rescue oxygenation through a bougie,
or the needle,
the cannula, the Leroy oxygenation tubing. None of those were available still. Mm. Yeah. Like, well, I still don't have those available. Instead of getting three-way taps, since my first experience, I've done simulation with Melka kit. I was comfortable. It's a Seldinger technique of an airway device, so I was comfortable, and we managed to put that in. And again, once that's in, we've got CO2. We're in theatre, we've got CO2. We can reverse resuscitation.
Yeah, amazing. It was essentially, you know, just a elaborate on the Melka kit. Like, this is, so you've got, like, the Seldinger technique is just something we use so commonly to get a big tube into a small tube. And the way we do it is you put a small tube in first, so, you know, a needle, often this is into a vein or the airway in this situation. Then you put a wire, take the cannula out, and now that wire is in the lumen that you want. And now you can put a really big thing. So whether it's a central line in the central vein, or if it's a pulmonary artery catheter, or a Rick line in your peripheral veins, or in this case, the larger Melka definitive tube, it now goes over the wire into this trachea. And after you take the wire and the device out, it's left with a very very ventilatable mini tracheostomy, which you couldn't fit otherwise if you hadn't got the needle and wire in first, because it's too big without a conduit. So yeah, it's an amazing little device.
Yeah, amazing. So, and that's what I think, you know, like today with those pre-packed CICO kits are just so handy, not just for us, also for the nursing staff, because you can see if they haven't got the training, they don't really know what cannula you need. You know, I was saying, get the biggest cannula, and the 18 was what I was presented at the time. But because your 18-gauge could fit through a wire, and I just proceeded with it without wasting more time.
It's interesting because the cannulas are very specific. So the actual Melka kit comes with a cannula, and your normal, for us, the B-Braun Intracan, safety Intracan cannulas, they have memory. So if you bend them, then they stay kinked, as well as the melcazone cannula. But the BD Insight, I think it is, they have no memory. Like they, if they fold up, they, you know, extend down. And I've got, again, a demonstration of this. So the cannula you use is very important. But if it, you know, luckily you had first go, you didn't mess it up. You didn't bend the cannula or distort it. So you still had a patent airway, which is really great.
Yeah, because it was 18 gauge, quite small, you know, I knew that I was in the airway. I knew I could get the milk kit in confidently. So I just proceeded with that without pre-oxygenation in between. But this is, you know, it was a lot of stress for the nurses as well, because it's something they've never had to do and they don't really know all the specific devices that we needed. The Melka kit that got open was one that does not have a cuff.
Oh, no.
I know.
Luckily, the swelling would have cuffed it.
So it was one without a cuff. So, again, we got it with dear life. We could get sets up to it. It's a lot better, much bigger caliber. Compared to a cannula, any sort, we patient was stabilized with sets of 90s most of the time.
Wow.
Dramas, lots of dramas.
Hey, so, you know, again, you've got N equals 2 experience, and I said most anaesthetists in the world probably have N equals 0 experience. And a lot of these crises where there's so much that needs to be done, you've got no time to do it before disaster occurs. What are the, do you have some kind of reflections on the human factors about this case?
I think comparing the first incident versus the second scenario was the first time, you know, you doubt yourself, possibly because you haven't had the training, you're quite junior at the time, and you're about to embark on something pretty scary. So there's a lot of mental hesitation there to, should I do this? You know, you try to put an LMA, get a best position, you know, in retrospect, I probably could be more decisive in decision making, because they just evolve so quickly. In these two cases, like I tell you, one minute they're talking to you, the next minute they're being resuscitated.
That's just
how quickly, and that's there's no time to waste in scenarios like this. I guess that first scenario provided me a lot of confidence and clinical experience to know that this is very, very, very likely to be a CICO scenario. Let's get the rescue devices available.
And to talk about that, so imagine that you think something is going towards a CICO situation. Like, you know, what, you know, if either you fail one technique and you start getting stuff ready, or you fail two superglottic techniques, so say bag mask and laryngoscope view was bad, while you're trying the LMA, why not just open up the CICU kit? It's very cheap to do that versus the time that you lose in trying to open stuff and get the confidence and then the potential death on the table. So it's really good to be able to do that parallel management and not worry that you're opening stuff up. You know, it's silly things that we worry about when it probably costs a few dollars to open
this
up.
I don't think cost was so much on my consideration. No. It's more, you know, especially in the first scenario, being so junior, am I going to cause more harm?
Do no harm, right?
Yeah, that's right. Am I going to, because it's something I've never had to do. I don't know how to do in real life. But what have you got to lose?
Exactly. And in your situation, this patient was already dead, essentially. You know, sad to say, CPR was happening. They were in cardiac arrest. You've got nothing to lose by especially doing what you know you need to do, which is cut the neck to do the surgical airway. But, you know, an interesting thing is, you know, in your situation, the patient had arrested. There's no doubt that someone needed to do this drastic measure to get the patient back. I always imagine that circumstance. I guess I tell this to my trainees that, you know, this might happen in theater where someone has a difficult airway, something's happened, and you try all your best intubation and bag mask optimized with Goodell, two hands, jaw thrust, and assist and everything, and you've tried a couple of LMAs, and there's nothing to say that if you've really pre-oxygenated the patient well and you've done all of that in a minute, the patient's sats are still going to be 100, but you know that you haven't got the airway and they're paralyzed. The next point is to absolutely prepare for the surgical airway and or reverse this patient to get them to spont vent again. So just in that thing, that I think the confidence you have now as a consultant is that when you try your best effort at each one of intubation, LMA insertion ventilation, and bag mask ventilation, regardless, once you get down to that third lifeline, you need to start thinking about CICU and getting that ready regardless.
Yeah, you need to start thinking before you actually needing to do it. And just so that it gives yourself, you know, mental preparation. How am I going to approach this? What technique am I going to use? It's the human factor, not so much technical factor, skill sets. Yeah, so definitely I would encourage people to, if, you know, in any event that you had to be in this situation, consider it early. Consider early, and because in both scenarios, the reason the patient arrested were because of hypoxemia, related cardiac, related respiratory arrest, and they were very reversible.
Yes,
a very simple technique like just putting a needle, some oxygen into it, was enough to reverse CPR on both scenarios. Even if you don't go through the whole drastic measures of cutting the neck, it's enough to buy you time to at least just let yourself have a mental break and say, what next? What do I need to do next?
Yeah. And that's probably something to highlight. I know there's been incidences over time where the patient has a hypoxemic arrest and CPR and aggressive CPR and very good CPR has prevented getting the airway. And it's one of those things that's extremely tricky. Have a discussion with your bosses and your colleagues about this, that in the moment where you know the reversible cause is, you know, X, in this case, hypoxemia, if chest compressions are making the solution, which is gaining the airway, difficult, that's something to discuss about, you know, temporarily ceasing CPR for 5-10 seconds or even more maybe. Again, very high-end stuff. Absolutely don't do this lightly. But to know that if chest compressions are impeding the solution, then you need to think about that and pause that. Yeah. Hey, we talked about a bit about familiarity. You mentioned familiarity, you know, but getting everything ready in theater. And we know that, you know, when you work outside of your normal environment, everything's different. The staff are different. They might not have the same shared mental model or the understanding of the words and equipment that you need. And this extends to whether I'm in a hospital I haven't worked on before, if I'm in a different ward, ED, ward, ICU versus theater. Yeah, what are your thoughts on, like, what are the things that you ideally wanted in your environment? Like, say you did go down to emergency. What's your ideal impending collapse of airway in emergency? You can't transfer the patient to the familiarity of theatre. What would you take down with you to make yourself the most familiar as possible?
Yeah, I would. Oh, that makes a huge difference because, like you say, people talk different jargons. Even this was on the ward in my first scenario, they had no idea what's an LMA. No one understand what an LMA is. So I had to, at the time, I requested the senior anesthetic nurse to come from theatre to the ward to assist me.
Yeah.
So she was my main assistant. So if you ever had to be in that scenario, bring your best assistant. Bring your best equipment, whatever that is, the one that you're most familiar, because in the foreign environment, they may not have what you want. So if you've got the luxury of time, collect your best personnel and equipment with you.
I like that. I remember having a scenario when I was training where it was overnight and I got called down because there was a failed airway in emergency. Sats were 40% on the phone call. I was like, well, this is going to be bad. So I literally just pointed to the nurse that I knew best and said, hey, I'm running down, bring down the video laryngoscope with you as you come down to help me, because I just want someone who knows my practice, knows what I'm thinking,
correct,
and has the best piece of equipment to
do. Correct. Yeah. It's more, it's a lot about, a lot of it is it's anticipation. The nurses that know what is going on and know what you need or like, able to anticipate by assisting you that way, and that's the biggest help.
Yeah. I'd always bring two anesthetic nurses who I know or from theatre, one with the laryngoscope, one with the difficult airway trolley, because they'll probably be coming a bit later than I am, and I'll just run down while everyone else is coming.
That would be ideal if you've got the luxury of two nurses that you can bring along. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
That's good.
The personnel is certainly definitely very important, and you know, if like I say, if you've got the luxury of time, bring what you are familiar with, because an emergency situation is not the time to learn to use a new device.
Yeah, that's right. Doesn't often go well, does it?
No.
Any other parts of human factors? I'm thinking role allocation, closed loop communication in a stressful environment. Was there anything else that you can remember? went well, or, you know, you wish people with, because people now talk about CRM or crisis resource management quite commonly. So these are all very contemporary, very utilized terms. But back in 2008, it wasn't a thing that was really talked about a lot.
No, at the time. And also it's in 2008, it was, you know, from memory, it's probably a little bit chaotic. I'm very tunnel vision about airway at the time. That was my main focus. And certainly if we had a leader that can delegate tasks, getting equipments, it would be helpful. But in the second scenario, where there was myself and another senior duty initiatives, it was unspoken, but we sort of knew who is in charge of what at a time.
Yeah.
The senior initiators would be allocating tasks to nurses, and like I say, because I've asked for the rescue devices, and I've declared out loud that I was happy to do it, so I took on that role. So the other initiatives were just managing the resource at the time while I was getting this done. And when we debriefed with nurses, and they felt like, you know, obviously quite, it's a rare event that they've never, no one else in that theatre had encountered a CICU scenario other than myself at the time. But they felt like instructions were clear. Maybe that was very, you know, we're very fortunate to have a senior duty initiatives giving instructions at the time.
Yeah. You almost need someone, like, because, you know, someone might be task focused and you'll need a senior practitioner for that, but you also need someone pretty senior to manage the whole scenario, you know, look at the arrest and how it's running, looking at the monitors, someone else maybe on the, I mean, you potentially, you often need multiple leaders or micro teams with leaders of each micro team. Yeah. I remember having a uterine rupture where really, it was like me running the resus airway breathing circulation side of things, whereas, you know, the surgeon needed absolutely to have their own team running the surgical side of things to stop the bleeding. Things were going bad, and that worked really well.
Yeah, I felt like it was intense, but it was structured the second time around, possibly because, you know, you've got two senior staff, you're in a theatre environment, all that plays a role in it. Very, very thankfully, of patients make full recovery. They had no recollections of what happened.
A relief.
What a relief. Was great outcome for.
And I think that's pretty much all I really wanted to cover. I think we went through kind of the background of how rare this incident is. We've gone through the protocols, talked about the situations, the techniques, and some of the situation and human factors that are associated. I'll give links to all the relevant documents, including NAP6, the Andrew Heard documents, NAP4 and the Andrew Heard CICO documents, and also to the Vortex approach, which is a really great simplified approach of this stuff. Is there anything else you wanted to add before we wrap it up?
The only thing I'll encourage people to, maybe if you do have the CICO kit in your hospitals, I know, yes, it costs a lot to open up a packet, but maybe have an open packet to share for training, just so that you are familiar with what is actually in the packet and how you use them when the need comes. That's
make sure. That's right. Every time you go to a new hospital,
no one ever had to do it again.
Exactly. Whenever you go to a new hospital, you check where the MH trolley is, the intralipid, the cardiac arrest trolley. What is your air equipment? What is your CICO kit? What does it look like? And what do your video laryngoscopes even look like? Absolutely.
That's right. Yeah, 100%.
And run these drills as much as you can. If you don't have specific SIM centers, like we've got an amazing SIM center and a team that would just run, you know, scenario after scenario every week, every month. So we get really down with this. But I think there's a lot of space where in theatre, you can run these as just hypothetical scenarios with your consultant, with your nurse, and it just helps everyone to learn that, especially if it's a slower list.
For sure.
Right. Hey, Ann, thank you so much for coming on board. I really, really appreciate you talking about this stuff.
Thank you for having me.
We'll end it there. Thanks very much for being on the show. Please share with anyone who might be interested, and we'll see you again next time.